welcome back to another episode of the Rare Disorder podcast of my Meet an Expert series. Today, I have a very special guest with me, Dr. Monco Leck. Dr. Leck, as he is known, is a professor of genetics at Yale University and an avid researcher with his own established lab, the Leck Lab at Yale. Dr. Leck, I am so excited to have you on my podcast today. Just to get started, and so my listeners can get to know you a bit, could you please give a brief introduction of yourself?
My name is Monco Leck, and as you said, I'm an assistant professor at Yale University School of Medicine. So before getting to here, I'll just talk a little bit about my journey to introduce myself. Is that I grew up in Australia, and that's the reason why I have an Australian accent, as the audience probably can already tell. And so I grew up in Australia, and I first started off in another field, and then I transitioned into medical research, particularly genetics. And then, you know, I did my PhD in Australia before traveling to America, firstly to Boston to do my postdoc because I was interested in training and becoming better. And Boston is one of the best places in the world to actually do that training. And then I did many research projects, which I'll touch upon in other questions, before going to Yale to start my own lab here and my own research group here to focus on some of the things that I'll touch upon in the upcoming questions.
All right, thank you for that introduction. Now just getting into the research aspect, I was just wondering, how did you get into research and what inspired you to get into this field and focus area of the Leck Labs at Yale?
Yeah, so most people don't know in the audience, but because I'm sitting on this chair, that I have a rare muscular dystrophy myself. So I'm a rare disease patient with a muscular dystrophy, and how it affects me on my day-to-day life is that I have difficulties walking, I have difficulties getting up, and difficulties picking up things off the ground. So things that people find quite straightforward and easy to do, I struggle with due to my disability and having muscular dystrophy. And, you know, I got a clinical diagnosis in my early 20s before I decided that I wanted to actually leave my successful career as a software developer at IBM because I was not satisfied. And that's how I got into research. You know, I wish it was more a love for science all this time in my life. But, you know, I have a love for computers before the love for science. But I was driven into science by my curiosity and also my drive to actually make an impact in rare disease research, because at the time it was very difficult to get a genetic diagnosis for patients as myself, and on top of that there was absolutely no treatment for people with rare diseases. So I wanted to contribute both, because for me, going to my day-to-day job in IBM doing software development just was not giving me the life satisfaction. I could use my intelligence and talent to actually make a company like IBM richer, or I could use that to make a more meaningful impact in the world and also be able to help myself and others like me.
Yeah, it is really inspirational that, like, behind all your research, you have, like, a personal story and a personal connection to what you do. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on, like, what the rare condition you have is, and then just, like, what some, like, hardships you may have come across with it and how you've been coping with it.
Yeah, so the rare condition I have, it's called limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. Limb-girdle muscular dystrophy is a rare form of muscular dystrophy that affects your limbs and your girdle region. So the girdle regions are your shoulders and your hips area, and they tend to be affected first, but eventually, you know, like a lot of the muscular dystrophies, all your muscles eventually do get affected and day-to-day life becomes very difficult. So the genetic basis of limb-girdle muscular dystrophies, a lot of the genes known to cause the disease have been discovered, but at the time, you know, and my diagnostic odyssey, it was not discovered. It took over 10 years to actually find the gene that was causing my disease, but eventually they did find the gene. So a lot of the genes that cause this disease are recessive. That means you need to have two copies that that are dysfunctional,
mm-hmm.
one from your mum, one from your dad, and that's underlies recessive diseases. So, you know, your parents are typically unaffected, they're carriers, and you the children of your parents have a 1 in 4 chance. So I come from a family of 7 people. Unfortunately, I drew the short end of the straw, being, you know, and my sister, my older sister, also has muscular dystrophy also. So how it impacts day-to-day life. So for example, I can't walk long distances. I need to use a wheelchair. And unlike most people that are unable to use their legs who use a wheelchair, I can't actually use my arms because my arms are affected also. So normally people with muscular dystrophy don't use wheelchairs. Maybe they do use it at the start of their disability, but later on they'll use an electric wheelchair.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and really like providing us insight into what this rare condition is. And then just like going off that, I was wondering if you have like any resources that you would recommend to people who also have a muscular dystrophy.
Well, I don't know about resources, but more recommendations. So one thing I do recommend, you know, I think most people with muscular dystrophy, particularly the adults, are quite resourceful in Googling and finding support groups, like, for example, on Facebook. But I highly recommend to sometimes use those support groups or go to patient conferences as a way of meeting people with the same day-to-day struggles. Because I think in day-to-day living, it's really hard sometimes on patients because they feel like people can't empathize with some of the challenges they have and things like that. That's the only recommendation I have. Reach out to, you know, communities, either online communities or also patient conferences. Though we're going through a pandemic, so some of those in-person conferences aren't as accessible, but there are online conferences, which I could argue is much better for rare disease patients that find it difficult to travel also.
Mm-hmm.
So these conferences are not just talking to other patients with similar conditions, but also healthcare professionals that, such as physiotherapists and things like that, giving tips and also talking about the importance of each one of them, because it's not just about managing the symptoms. There are other things with living with rare disease, such as mental illness and other things that sometimes are neglected because people are more focused on the obvious and things that can be seen.
Yeah, I 100% like agree with you about what you said about mental health. And in fact, like most of the patients that I have interviewed have commonly mentioned that their rare disease really has affected their mental health, whether that's being looked down upon by other people or just anything like that. So thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, and it's something that I always say to parents of rare disease patients, whether their children are toddlers or their children's, particularly if their children are young adults or teenagers, I find that parents are more focused on the obvious. I'm going, what you should be more focused on
mm-hmm.
is their mental health and how they're going, because I think it's very difficult as a young adult and teenager to transit, you know, you're going through major transitions in life and not being able to do things that your peers are able to do, like, for example, go to college and live by themselves and not having, you know, feeling like
mm-hmm.
you're missing out, or, you know, as young people would say, FOMO. And I think sometimes it's hard for parents to understand that because they're more focused on, you know, the day-to-day symptoms that the family member feels.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And like another trend I've noticed is that patients also say that people are more focused on like the outside, like their visual appearance, rather than like something may be wrong in their body. So yeah, I think it's really important to address that aspect as well. All right. So as you know, I'm a podcast host and I interview different patients who have rare diseases and conditions in order to help educate the public and then also provide them a platform to share their story. So many of the fighters who are people I have had on my podcast have struggled to find the cause of their disorders or make sense of their condition and often look into connecting with the rare disease community to make sense of it all. And I can only imagine how perplexing this could be. And your lab, the LEC lab, focuses on helping find definite diagnosis for rare genetic conditions. So I was just wondering, like, how can methods and techniques used in your lab be taken mainstream to help explain such unexplained conditions that many fighters are looking for explanations for? And then also, like, where possible cures and treatments for them?
Oh, wow, that's a long question, a long statement, but let me break that down. So I don't think, so just to let the audience know, who are, you know, some of the people in the audience are trying to find answers for their rare disease, where they believe it's a genetic cause. So just to put everything in context, why this is still an active area of research, we know that with rare diseases, the genetic diagnosis rate is only around 50%, sometimes a little bit higher, sometimes a little bit lower, depending on the rare disease itself, but it sits around 50%. And if you can think about that, that's only one in two people actually know the genetic cause of their disease. I want to make a distinction between the two things. One is a clinical diagnosis where, for example, if you're a neuromuscular disease patient, a neurologist would examine you in the clinic, get your family history, run multiple tests, and make a clinical diagnosis. And clinical diagnosis is just based on, you know, I hate to say it, opinion, or based on what you're presenting with. And sometimes that opinion sometimes change that diagnosis. Well, genetic diagnosis is when you look at a patient's DNA, you look at its all the genes in the DNA and find what we call pathogenic variants. We tend to not use the word mutation anymore, and look for pathogenic variants and in genes known to be associated with their disease or what they're presenting with in the clinic. And a genetic diagnosis is a lot more definitive rather than, it never changes. You sequence someone's DNA one day, you sequence it 10 years from now, it does not change.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that does change, and this is the challenge in rare disease genetics, is the interpretation. So the data itself does not change. If you have a pathogenic variant and a particular gene, that will not change. But what changes is that interpretation. So one of the challenges is finding the pathogenic variant in patients, which can be quite tricky because sometimes it's not in a gene, so it's in intergenic regions. So the genes and the coding regions of genes only make up for about 2% of the human genome. 98% of the genome is what we call intergenic and repetitive regions, where we don't know its association with disease, but, you know, it is the next place we will look, but it's very hard to interpret that. And so the thought is some of those unsolved cases actually lie there. The other place would be the assumption that diseases are only caused by one gene. It could be caused by multiple genes and the interaction of those pathogenic variants in that gene. And the other thing to note is that that another possibility is that there is no disease gene and it's not actually genetic. So one example for muscular dystrophies is it could be an autoimmune disease. So it's an interaction with the environment and, you know, unfortunately the body attacking itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in terms of the second half of the question, the treatment part is that, you know, a lot of patients such as myself earlier on always have this sort of like, and I don't blame them, this sort of like thought that, what does it mean for me to have a genetic diagnosis, know the gene, know the mutation that caused my disease, if there is no treatment? You know, it's a philosophical question, but an important one, because I had the same sort of like outlook also going, what does it matter? If after knowing, we can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we can, you know, if you think about it, you know, from a, you know, a higher point of view, there are two ways we can do something about it. The first is a lot of these genetic diseases have the same trajectory or progression. So, you know, there is some variability between patients to patients, but if you know that, say, for example, it has a cardiac involvement, or you know in 10 to 15 years most patients are in a wheelchair, you can plan ahead, manage, and also delay through proactive, being very proactive. So, for example, in my situation, I would get an ultrasound on a regular basis so I can monitor my heart and, you know, and be more proactive in terms of looking after the heart, and also medications I can take to look after it, instead of waiting for something bad to happen and then managing the symptoms and being reactive. The other reason, and I think this is the exciting part of our research and where research is going, is that we're in the age of genetic therapies. The ability to use gene therapy through viruses to deliver a replacement of the defective gene, or hopefully in the very near future, to also edit patients' genomes to edit the mutation that's actually causing their disease. You know, there is a lot of research into this, and I need to emphasize to the audience who don't have a genetic diagnosis, if you don't know what gene and what mutation is causing your disease, then you can't actually apply these cutting-edge approaches. And these are more promising because you're not managing your conditions and symptoms. You're not or taking steroids that are, again, addressing the symptoms. You're actually addressing the root cause of your disease. And being a genetic disease, the DNA, the gene that's defective, and things like that. And that's why it shows more promise. But although that promise, I do have some caution that some rare disease patients think that this is a cure. You know, replacing the defective gene or correcting something cannot reverse the progression of the disease. So, for example, if you've lost a lot of muscle mass on your limbs and things like that, you will not reverse that. It will only halt further progression of muscle wasting and weakness. So it's something, you know, unfortunately, that is the way nature works. It's not regenerative. It's more by putting back something you're missing through genetic technologies. You only can halt the progression.
All right, thank you so much for sharing that. I just wanted to touch on one thing you said about like the different gene therapies and stuff like that. So this really reminded me of like a patient I interviewed, and her story really resonated with me. So she was an undiagnosed patient. However, she knew she had a polygenic disease, and what she would do is she would bring her doctor like fact sheets. She would research the condition on her own and present her doctor with like research she had done overnight and stuff like that. And she also named this condition on her own because when she went to the doctor, they really didn't have an answer for her. So that just what you said really reminded me of that patient I had interviewed, so I just wanted to add on.
I just want to add to that point. I think we do live in the information age, and you know, sometimes you know, I can reflect upon, you know, first going on this journey, and I talk about this in the TEDx talk, that sometimes neurologists and the healthcare professionals that patients see can sometimes be quite condescending, you know. They make assumptions of the intelligence of their patients, but you know, there is no correlation between being a rare disease patient and your IQ and intelligence, you know. And for me, sometimes I think the medical field should listen more, and also not make the assumption that they're actually smarter than their patient. They may be more knowledgeable at the moment, but an intelligent patient with the right resources and also the right frame of mind for learning could actually be an expert at that field, you know. And you know, and just for healthcare professionals to acknowledge that, and also to acknowledge that they have a greater motivation. So, for example, for me, I'm the one struggling with muscular dystrophy every day. I don't expect my neurologist to think about me day and night, to read every paper on my disease. And for my neurologist to think that, you know, that sometimes they're more knowledgeable than your disease, sometimes it's wrong. And I read somewhere, and this made me really upset, you know, that they used the 23andMe data and surveys from the data to find out that patients with muscular dystrophy have cold, lower legs, that, you know, they feel their legs are cold. And I'm going, that is not fact. You don't have to, you know, sometimes scientists are so disconnected, you know. One of the things that, from my time at being at Massachusetts General Hospital, that I was quite annoyed about, I'm going, all these people are studying, you know, my colleagues are all studying genetic diseases and things like that, but they've never met a patient with that genetic disease. And I thought that was just too much of a disconnect, you know. To think you're an expert in disease but never even meet a patient with that disease, I think it's just really, really arrogant would be the word.
Yeah, and also, like, what you were saying about the medical field needing to listen more. So a lot of patients that I have come across, they have said that, like, they have went doctor to doctor and, like, their doctors are either not knowledgeable about their condition or they just don't listen to them because it's obviously, like, not a common condition. And they get really frustrated with their doctors and it's just, like, really hard to find a doctor for them. And, like, one patient in particular, she was mentioning to me, like, how she has to travel across state lines for her doctor. So, like, whenever she's having a problem, she has to drive, like, 2 to 3 hours to this hospital just because, like, the doctors around her either, like, don't listen to her or there's just, like, no one to treat her condition near her.
Yeah, I just want to add, but, you know, just to be fair and balanced, in the defense of doctors, okay, a lot of the conditions we talk about are quite rare. So it may be one in a million. There may be only 5 people in the United States with it. So it's impossible for a doctor to be an expert in every rare condition. But all I ask for doctors is to listen. And also, it's okay to not know everything. You know, your patients will understand if you just say, look, I'm not an expert in what disease I think you have. However, there is a specialist, you know, in the next state, you should go and see them because I can't actually offer you any more help. And I think the patients would appreciate that rather than taking a more arrogant point of view or thinking that they need to know everything because no one knows everything.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, at least referring them to, like, a specialist or someone who specializes in that would really help, rather than just, like, keeping the patient there when they may not know much about their condition. All right, so I was just wondering, like, how your technology that you have created and also your research can help provide answers to the undiagnosed patients. And then if you could also just talk about, like, any additional resources that my listeners with undiagnosed rare conditions can possibly tap into.
Yeah, so I'll answer the first question first. So one of the exciting areas of research that I'm interested in is going back to that 50% diagnosis rate. One of the challenges of is the interpretation of variants. What we know in human genetics is that just because that people who have rare diseases are caused by rare mutations. And this is common sense, because if it was caused by common mutations or common variations or variants in the population, then there should be more people by logic with that disease. So they're caused by these very rare variants. But the other thing we know in human genetics is just because a variant is rare, it doesn't mean it's disease-causing. And that's the challenge, that even healthy people have rare variants in genes known to cause disease, yet they don't have disease because these variants don't have any impact on the DNA, the RNA, and also the protein. So a lot of rare variants, when they actually go through genetic testing, are what we call variants of uncertain significance, or and they're called that because we're not sure if they cause disease or are benign, so therefore not cause disease. And one of the things that my research was focused on when I was at the Broad Institute doing my postdoc and also at Massachusetts General Hospital back in Boston, Massachusetts, is actually creating the largest catalog of human protein coding variants. So variants in genes. By knowing what variants we find in the general population or the relatively healthy population, we can then ask the question, this rare variant we find in patients, how often do we find it in the population? And knowing how common or rare the disease is, you can sort of like lean towards it being benign or pathogenic. So if you discover a variant in a patient, know that it's quite common in the population, it's less likely to actually cause a rare disease. It kind of makes logical sense, but you actually have to have that information to make that conclusion. And you actually have to be quite sure. So to be quite sure is to have tens of thousands of tens of thousands of individuals and having genetic variants from them. And that will actually give you the power to actually be more certain of how common a variant that you find in a rare disease patient is in the population. But however, that is only as good as that database. And that database or data set of variants we find in the population, also breaking down to, you know, people of European descent, people of, mm-hmm. say, Asian descent, South Asian, and, say, African-American descent, Latino descent, what it doesn't tell you is no matter how big you make that, you can't actually model every possible genetic variant in a gene. So one thing that, you know, I want to focus on in my research lab in Yale is technologies, what we call it is the ability to put in every possible mutation in a gene and then push it through a high throughput assay. And a high throughput assay that's measuring something that is physiologically relevant to the disease. And that way you don't have to observe it in the population because you're actually, what we call it in computer science, brute forcing every combination. And seeing what the outcome is. And the result is having a lookup table. So we're not waiting for a patient with a particular mutation to come in. We know what the functional consequence of every possible mutation. Hopefully you kind of understand that and the benefits of doing that, because cataloging people, you only get the variants that you see in the population, and it never covers every possible variant in a gene. And by brute forcing it, we actually have another line of evidence. So in clinical genetics or genetic diagnosis, you can't just use information in isolation. It's always in combination with each other to build up a case or evidence. We never use that information in isolation. So it's a combination of looking at how a pathogenic variant or potential pathogenic variant, the word for it is segregate in the family. So do the affecteds have it? Do the unaffecteds not have it? And all these other things. And, you know, do the gene we suspect, is that typical of that disease and things like that? So it's bringing all these evidence together to actually make a conclusion. So yeah, our focus, going back full circle, our focus is, you know, the variants of uncertain significance and adding to that information or that population information that I worked on during my postdoctoral studies.
So I was wondering if you could like elaborate a little bit more on like how you mentioned that when you're doing these surveys, it's important to consider race and like how like some populations might have like more prevalent rare diseases and some might have less.
Yeah, so the reason why genetic ancestry is important is because some rare variants are only found in a particular place in the world. So a lot of these rare variants, because of their rarity, are considered very young variants. So they happen quite recently in the history of humans. So it may be that, you know, we know that each individual carries about 50 to 100 rare variants, depending on your definition of rare variants. So if your definition is 0.5% or less of the population having it, it'd be around 50 to 100. And what happens in the history of rare variant is, say your great grandparent gets it, and then, you know, it gets inherited down, you know, down your family tree. And so if it's only, you know, restricted to your family tree, which we call a private variant, you can see that obviously it will be restricted to whatever ancestry you are, you know, or the ancestry of your first descendant that had that variant. And that's why it's important, because a lot of these rare variants are only found in one place or one region of the world because of its sort of like history of that variant and it going through, you know, a family tree, but extended family tree when you go back a few generations. And therefore, it's important to know just not is this variant common in the population, but is this variant common in the population you're from.
Mm-hmm.
So my personal story, okay, the reason why it took quite a long time to find, you know, my mutation is that they made this assumption that the disease I had was rare, I could have was rare in Europeans. Unfortunately, I'm not of European descent. So one of the challenges we do have in medical research, not just in genetics, medical research at the moment is it is very, very white centric. And so, and unfortunately, you know, genetic ancestry and things like that does impact human health and human health outcomes. And it should be more aware, so, you know, of the impact genetic variants have in different populations and its frequency in different populations. And we find that with a lot of things, like for example, cystic fibrosis is a disease typically found in Northern Europeans because of a few founder mutations. That's the same with Thai Sachs amongst the Jewish community and things like that because of it staying in a particular region of the world. And, you know, and with rare disease, we have to be particularly mindful of some diseases that are typical for regions of the world because of that founder mutation.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, like, environmental factors can lead to these as well?
That is a really good question, and it's still an understudied part of rare disease research, you know, what impact environment has. But what we know with the more severe rare diseases is it has little impact, that if you have a genetic mutation that's known to cause a particular disease, and the word for it is fully penetrant, that you will get the disease. Sometimes it's hard to sort of like predict at what age, what exact age it will happen. And that's due to, as you said, the environment and also your genetics. Your genetics will always be different to your siblings and things like that. And then the environment, the contribution from environment. It's a question that's hard to answer, mainly because if we were looking at how genetics interacts with an environment, and we're talking about rare diseases, like all rare disease research, we can't get enough patients with a particular disease or a particular disease variant, so we'll never ever have the power to actually make statistically significant conclusions. And that's the challenge with working with rare disease cohorts as opposed to working with common disease cohorts, or we're living through a pandemic looking at, you know, patients that received a vaccine. There are millions and millions of people you could actually do research on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's, like, really hard to, like, come to a conclusion on, like, some topics for rare diseases, especially since, like, rare disease patients are, like, scattered all over the world. And, yeah, so I was just thinking about that. Okay, so just, like, going back to the technology that you have in your lab, I was wondering if there was, like, an instance or scenario that you recall where people's lives were changed through the results which were achieved through this cutting-edge technology, which does exome sequencing.
Yeah, so I'm going to touch upon one of the stories. So exome sequencing, just to let the audience know, because I haven't actually touched upon that genomic technology, but I have touched upon about 1 to 2% of the genome are actually genes, or the coding regions of genes. And exome sequencing only captures those regions, so the regions that encode for the proteins. So you go from genes to protein to RNA, then to proteins. And it's the proteins that are what we call the machines that do the work in your body. So most of the diseases that we study, especially, you know, rare diseases or Mendelian diseases, is actually looking at the impact that these variants have on the protein. You know, I'm not going to go on the RNA because let's just stick to topic. So exome sequencing is mainly concerned with those regions that encode for protein. So it's another way of saying, let's not sequence the whole genome because we can't interpret the other 98%. Let's just capture the regions that we can interpret and then look at any genetic variants we see there. So let's just stick to the bits we can. So the 20,000 or so genes and their protein coding regions. And so exome sequencing allows us to rapidly, if there is an obvious known cause of someone's genetic disease, allows us rapidly get to that. And how it can make impact, okay? Going back to some of my points of why it's important to get a genetic diagnosis is that sometimes people get a clinical diagnosis and it's actually wrong. Sometimes a lot of diseases look like each other. And so one of the projects I work on is limb-girdle muscular dystrophy and, you know, the disease I have, and we do exome sequencing on it. And there are some diseases that look like limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, and one of them is myasthenia gravis. Okay, myasthenia gravis is a disease of the neuromuscular junction, and it's an autoimmune disease, and it presents very similar to limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, and there are genes associated with a myasthenia gravis. Okay, and if you make those discoveries of those genes, there is actually treatment. So a patient goes from, I have limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, there is no treatment for my disease, going, okay, I got the wrong diagnosis and it's been proven by the variant, the pathogenic variants in my gene, there is treatment for me. And so it does make a huge impact from someone struggling from day-to-day life to having treatment that has improved their condition. So there are many stories like this. We call them differential diagnosis, diseases that look like each other, but after we perform something like exome sequencing, we get to a better diagnosis or the correct diagnosis. And, you know, at the end of the day, the patient doesn't dwell on why did I have the wrong diagnosis for so long. They're just so happy that, you know, now they have the right diagnosis, and in some cases there is treatment rather than no treatment and then having no hope. So yeah. You know, I find them very rewarding knowing that, you know, not that other case where we find a genetic cause is not rewarding, because it's the hope that someday, you know, down the track, that there is a therapy for them, whether it's addressing the root cause or just the symptoms. But knowing what it is the first step.
I've actually talked to a patient who actually had the wrong clinical diagnosis in the past. And then she went to a second doctor just to confirm the diagnosis. And she was actually diagnosed with a different condition, not the one like her first doctor had told her. And she was just like really happy, and like, because now she like knew what she had, so she can now explore like further treatment options and stuff like that. So yeah, I just wanted to share that story. So I was just wondering if you could also like elaborate more on the development process of the technology, and then also like what kind of inspired it.
The technology, I can talk about the development process, but it's not something that, you know, I personally was responsible for. But I can talk about a technology that has revolutionized not just rare disease genetics, but genetics in general. And, you know, it's a technology that I think we now take for granted. And the technology is called next generation sequencing technology. I know it's a very generic name for a technology. You know, if you're going to reword it, it's massive parallel sequencing. So it's the ability to get DNA, break it up to chunks, and sequence millions and millions of these chunks, small chunks, simultaneously. And this technology has allowed us to do so many things in genetics, and one of the things I already touched upon is exome sequencing. The reason why we're able to look at genetic variants in 20,000 genes or more in a, you know, in a human individual is the ability to parallelize that and sequence millions and millions of these chunks of DNA at the same time. These chunks of, so first of all, we capture the regions, that 2% of the genome, and then we send it to the sequencer to sequence it in parallel. And I think that technology has had the most dramatic impact in modern day genetics, whether it's rare disease genetics to other genetic discoveries, such as, for example, single cell sequencing, which is thought to be, as Chan Zuckerberg would say at the Chan Zuckerberg Institute, would be the human genome project of our generation, the ability to map and identify every single cell or cell type in the human body. And that is all powered through next generation sequencing, the ability to sequence the RNA or a subset of the RNA in each one of the cells isolated from human tissue. So I just want to mention that technology. It's empowered my research. It's empowered other research. You know, I have no contribution to that technology, but it's the most important technology in genetics in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that's like a really transformative technology. I think I've like heard of it before. And it's making a lot of advancements in like the field of genetics overall. So we kind of touched on this in our previous previous recording, but I understand that the LEC Lab is focused on patients in underserved populations and geographies with little access to cutting edge research. So I was wondering, like, where specifically have you had the most patients from, and do you see a correlation between where people live, their lifestyles, level of access to quality healthcare, etc., with their rare genetic disorders?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, when I first started in my lab, I did want to touch upon underserved populations, particularly in the Asia Pacific region. Ironically, that's where most of the world is. So, you know, that's where you'd get the large cohorts. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, things haven't gone to plan. But I am going to touch upon a region of the world that I did work on during my postdoctoral studies and continue to work on when I came here, and that's patients in Eastern Europe. You know, another very poor area, not as poor as other areas, but still an underserved region of the world. And what we tend to find is when we do genetic studies on them, on their undiagnosed rare disease patients, that the discoveries we make are not novel scientific discoveries. That the genes associated, say, in this case, limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, that we do make discoveries in the Eastern European population are actually known the most common causes of limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. So, yes, we didn't make any novel discoveries, but I also think about the impact we make on patients' lives, and also, you know, and also having those countries and the doctors and urologists involved in those countries be exposed to this new technology, that they can actually make a case to their respective governments and, you know, health departments why it's actually important to actually do things like that, you know. So even though we didn't make any novel scientific discovery, I do find it personally rewarding myself that we could bring a technology that's not readily available. And how does that change the life of the patients? Like I said before, now they know what the prognosis is, how the disease will progress, that they can be more proactive in the care. And not to mention, this is one thing I haven't mentioned, is that for family planning reasons also, knowing, you know, what genes to screen for in their partner, you know, they don't have to, but now they're empowered with that information. They can choose. They have more choice in that. and also knowing, you know, if they have other children or affected siblings, for them to screen for the gene. But again, no one's forced to do anything in genetics, but it's just having that information and power to actually do something now.
Yeah, and that they can, like now, like, advocate for themselves in the doctor setting and so on. So I was just wondering if there's, like, anything else you would like to add for the benefit of my podcast listeners today. It can be, like, any advice to rare disease patients, any resources you would like to share, just anything like that.
So the advice I want to give the rare disease patients is, you know, as I said, that about 50% of rare disease patients probably don't have a definitive genetic diagnosis, okay? It's for them to persist, okay? And not to give up, you know? It is a very active area of research. And the reason why people shouldn't give up is, hopefully I've got it across, it allows you to take, as I said in the TEDx talk, more control of your genetic destiny, and, you know, and not to just, you know, just roll over and give up. Sometimes it's very hard when a disease is very debilitating, things like that. But, you know, having that hope and having that more control over your situation, I hope that, you know, just inspires them, because, you know, at the end of the day, the thing I want to tell a rare disease patient is, no one will care about your disease and what you go through more than you. So you have to actually be proactive for yourself too. You know, no one, you know, if you have a neuromuscular disease, no one feels the pain and embarrassment of falling in general public, you know, places and things like that. And, you know, for me, it's hard. But, you know, but at the same time, if you don't help yourself, sometimes it's hard for others to help you.
Yes. And then one thing I would also say is that if they have an opportunity to, and if they feel comfortable with it, they should really share their story, whether that's through, like, an Instagram platform or any other form of social media. And go ahead.
I can jump in that. There is a website that I really enjoy going to. It's called The Mighty. It's a place for people to self-advocate for themselves, to share with the world some of the challenges they have. And I think if you want people to understand what you're going through, empathize more with what you're going through, or at least sympathize, is to write something, you know? And you know, it's not just other rare disease patients that are reading that. There are, you know, it's open to anyone to read when they Google and want to, especially say if you want to understand your friend's disease better, they'll probably land on The Mighty, and, you know, and it's a patient's perspective of the challenges they go through in life. So, you know, I, sorry to interrupt you, I just want to say that because I've had a positive experience writing on there.
Yeah, and then another, like, resource that is similar to that is R Odyssey, which is, like, a platform where they allow patients to, like, create a little blog post and share their story. And then I would also say Allstripes. You can become an ambassador for your rare condition, and there's lots of, like, resources and opportunities for you to share your story through that organization. So I would just say, like, there's something for everyone, whether you want to be vocal about your story or you want to be involved with, like, legislation, for example. I know that I'm becoming involved with RDLA, which is a legislative advocacy program for patients and those who are interested in learning about rare diseases or advocating for them. And so some things they do are, like, encouraging, like, one thing that I really appreciate that they do is advocating for ICD codes, because this is one thing that a lot of rare patients, or, like, rare diseases, don't have ICD codes for them, which is what the doctor uses to log down the condition. So that is, like, one thing that really drew my attention when I was participating with them, so I just wanted to mention that. All right, so just, like, to end off with a kind of fun question, I was just wondering, like, what is a topic that when you engage with it seems to make you lose track of time?
You know, like my first love, like I said at the start of the podcast, has been computers. I still enjoy programming. I still enjoy computational problems. So I would say actually working on computational problems, especially computational problems where I'm actually making something new. And the way you lose yourself in it or lose time in it is, you know, it's a process. You know, there are errors, there are mistakes, you know, bugs, you fix it, you know, it's a long process, but it's an enjoyable process because at the end you have something, you know, something tangible you can show your friends, you can share with the world and things like that. And so it's something I always lose time, you know, and you know, time just flies when I'm doing it. And the other thing that time flies is, you know, looking at cool new results with students and, you know, and thinking about, oh, what can we do next? That is also really awesome, you know, in my current job now leading a team of, you know, young scientists and seeing their excitement also, and, you know, playing what we'll do next. Time gets lost always.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I agree, like, in the past, I've taken a computer science class, and I created an app from scratch, and it was honestly, like, really engaging and interesting to just, like, see the result, after, like, all the hard work I had put into it, and, yeah.
It probably gives you also an appreciation for other apps you use, how much hard work it took just to get something simple to work.
Yeah, and you really like don't realize like how much work is behind it until you actually do it yourself. It may just like seem as like a simple tool to you, like I just click this button and I go to this website, but like the behind the scenes is really just like a lot more complicated than you'd think. All right, so just to kind of close off now, I would like to thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Leck, and sharing all this wonderful information with my podcast listeners. I really appreciate you taking the time out to be on my podcast today, and I know that my listeners will be equally appreciative.
Thanks. Yeah, it was great to have this opportunity to share with other rare disease patients and people interested in rare diseases.